Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
These days, F1 drivers have all the personality of a gently steamed leek. But they weren't always so dull.
Kimmy, you missed the presentation.
I was having a shit.
From shootouts with drug lords to week-long orgies, meet F1's biggest shaggers, wrong'uns, and hellraisers.
Fucking look like rock stars, huh? And now we are a fucking bunch of wankers.
My name is Jack Rivlin. I'm joined, as always, by Zach Sweeney-Lynn.
Hello.
Hello. And we have got regular guest and sometime pit lane interviewer, Mr. George Cooper here.
Hello, you alright, Jack?
You've done a few grid walks in your time, haven't you?
I don't know about grid walks, but yeah, I did work on the F1 circuit for a portion of the 2022 season. Very much there in a work capacity. I certainly wasn't invited to any of those week-long orgies that you referred to in the intro. But given the somewhat corporate nature of the sport that I saw, I wouldn't be surprised if those sort of antics were from an F1 of yesteryear, shall we say.
Generally, F1 is, I alluded to it in the intro, it's a slightly tamer place now, isn't it, Zach, than it once was?
I think we'll touch on some of the stories from the 70s and 80s in this podcast, but in that era, it was really this like playboy world. I think there was always a lot of money in it, but it was obviously way more dangerous at that time than it is now. I mean, it's still dangerous now, but it just has such a sort of hedonistic streak that I think sort of money and sponsorship is kind of sucked out of it now. It's very sad. It's the same with a lot of sports. It's the same with the Premier League, that the characters are not quite so wild as they were, I think.
There's a quote from Stirling Moss, who they call him the greatest driver to never win the championship. And he said, "In my day, the drivers used to go out after a race and chase crumpet. These days, they thank Vodafone." Increasingly, that quote says more about Stirling Moss than anything else. I read in research for this pod that he used to keep a red book and a black book at his home in London. The red book was for all his race performances, and the black book was every girl he'd ever slept with, which is fucking weird.
That's very creepy.
So creepy. But you know, like, obviously in the 80s, that everyone thought that was like, fucking, what a legend. And now you're like, that's creepy.
Also, he used the word crumpet as well. That's of a bygone era, isn't it?
He used the word crumpet a lot. It was almost his like catchphrase. Different times.
Indeed.
All right, well, speaking of different times, should we get into it with a glorious playboy from the past?
Right? Yeah, so we're going to start with probably F1's most notorious playboy, James Hunt, who was a British driver. He drove for McLaren in the 70s. He famously had sex breakfast of champions embroidered on his overalls.
What does that even really mean? Does that just mean like have sex in the morning?
I guess. Yeah.
I love sex. I
mean. Yeah, if you have to embroider that onto your overalls, like that's surely it's not the most playboy thing to do. Really. Yeah. Maybe it is. I don't know.
Who sewed it on? Was it a patch?
I think it was his mum.
Yeah. Yeah. Was he 14?
One of those iron-on patches? Yeah. While you're sewing my name on behind the collar, do you mind putting this on as well? But he had this reputation for being a massive shagger, but he was also a really good driver. He won the 1976 World Championship, had this really epic battle with Niki Lauda, the Austrian driver, who at that time Niki Lauda was the reigning champion, and he, during the 1976 season, he was leading the championship for most of the way, but kind of neck and neck with James Hunt, until Niki had a really, really terrible crash. Like, he spun off the car, set on fire, he got really badly burned, inhaled loads of toxic fumes, ended up in a coma, and they read him the last rites. So everyone's thinking he's a goner. He made this like miraculous recovery, somehow only missed two races, and then came back with like this really big scar. He lost his ear, had like really bad scarring on his face. But because he missed those two races, James Hunt caught up with him in the championship. They were, I think he was a couple of points behind by the final race.
There's a story about this that Niki Lauda, years later, an American newspaper took him back to the scene of the crash. I think it's the Nürburgring in Germany. And they took him back to the scene of the crash, and the paper wanted this like really emotional, serious interview. You can imagine, you know, like quite a touching moment as Niki visits the exact site. Apparently when they got there, when the journalist was looking away for a second, Niki Lauda just whipped out a bit of raw chicken from his pocket, threw it on the grass and just goes, "There's my ear!" Which I think captures a lot of the humour. I mean, those guys were fucking hard as nails back then, right? Because they were constantly risking death, but they were quite like, they had good gallows humour about it.
Yeah, that's he always comes across as quite nice, I think. He was very magnanimous in when he conceded victory in the title race to James Hunt. So there's a good story around the final race. So it's like going into the season ending Japanese Grand Prix. James Hunt's, I think, 3 points behind Niki Lauda, and he gets stationed at this plush hotel in Fuji in the lead up to the race. And, you know, you'd think he's got the biggest race of his career coming up. He could win the world championship. So you'd think he'd just, you know, get a few early nights and visualize victory. But instead, he invites along his best mate, Barry Sheen, who's the motorcycle world champion. And the two of them were like basically the big British playboys of the 70s. And they have this like 2 week booze, cocaine fueled bender at this hotel, which also conveniently for them happens to be a stop off for the British Airways cabin crew. So basically every day there'd be a new cohort of stewardesses that are arriving at the hotel. And according to Alistair Caldwell, who's the McLaren team manager, he said, "Every morning, James would bounce up to the girls in his shorts and bare feet and say, 'Hello, I'm James Hunt,' and take them straight upstairs for a party. This happened every day for a fortnight." So he's basically just having this 2 week orgy at the hotel in the run up to the race day. And I think his team were sort of tolerating it. It's a bit like, okay, whatever, James, like, if this is what you need to get you in the zone for the to let off some steam before the big race, then you go for it. But their patience is tested on race day when minutes before the start of the race, he's nowhere to be found. So they're all frantically searching around the paddock, trying to find James, when one of the mechanics finds this unlocked pit garage and comes in and finds James Hunt there with his trousers around his ankles with a local Japanese girl.
Air stewardess as well?
I don't know if she's an air stewardess. I'm imagining one of the sort of champagne holding...
They often are cabin crew, aren't they? Is it me or is there some weird F1 cabin crew overlap?
Is it because they're all sponsored by Emirates? Maybe. Or the races?
But even back then as well, the BA thing.
Yeah, maybe. No. Yeah,
I think it was like quite a glamorous job back then, wasn't it? Like, yeah, hostess. It's not like your standard sort of Ryanair flight to Dublin.
So is this race day where he's shagging in the pit lane?
Yeah, this was literally before the final race of the season where he's like going for the title.
Against Niki Lauda.
Niki Lauda. He ends up, Niki Lauda has another nightmare and has to drop out of the race. Apparently the reason is because he was struggling because he was unable to blink because of the burns from his crash. Yeah.
That is nuts that you'd get back in a car.
Yeah. But so poor Niki Lauda doesn't finish the race and James Hunt finishes third, which means he gets 4 points. So he ends up winning the title by 1 point.
Wow.
And true to form goes off on another enormous bender. So...
Do you not think that that's like slightly insensitive? You imagine that happened now, like you're like Verstappen and Hamilton in a head-to-head battle and then the Hamilton end up in a coma and then that then causes you. You think that you'd have a bit of a muted celebration.
Just spraying the champagne.
But no.
It's literally the only reason you've won the title is because your rival was in a coma for like 2 weeks.
During the last rites.
Yeah. And you celebrate with a two-month orgy pendant.
It's what he would have wanted.
But I think I was saying before that Niki Lauda was quite magnanimous about James Hunt winning the title.
Lauda won it himself.
He won it three times, I think. He won it the season before, and then I think he won 77 and...
How are you not retiring?
Like that.
At the point you can't blink and you've lost an ear, how are you not retiring?
Amazing. I guess by that point, it's like, where do you go from there, really?
Anyway, back to James Hunt.
So he wins the title, has this massive bender. Bernie Eccleston has block booked this flight back to the UK. It's like Japan Airlines flight. And they basically have like a 12-hour mid-air party and just drink the plane dry. They land at Heathrow and there's thousands of people waiting to greet Hunt. He like... door opens and he sort of stumbles down the stairs and he's greeting his fans, among whom is his girlfriend, who I imagine was not too pleased when she found out about the 33 air stewardesses. Yeah. But they then head off to the British Embassy where there's a reception for James. But he arrives there and he's basically so drunk that the British ambassador tries to not let him into the embassy. Eventually they sort of sober him up and he agrees to let him in. So after James Hunt eventually retires and has a brief stint as a co-commentator for Murray Walker, the legendary F1 commentator, it doesn't last too long though. There's one of his first races, he turns up super drunk already and proceeds to neck two bottles of rosé during the race and starts just like slurring his words. And at one point, Murray Walker like reports that one of the drivers who's not doing very well is like blaming his bad race on an engine change. And Hunt just like leans forward and slurs into the mic.
And all I can say to that is bullshit.
live on BBC.
what happened to Hunt in the end?
He sadly died of a heart attack.
Oh God,
he's quite 25.
Young. Lived fast, die young.
Yeah, literally.
He smoked like 60 a day, I think.
Oh really?
Yeah,
that's what it really was.
There was a good interview actually where he's been interviewed after the race during his driving days, and the interviewer just asks him a question. He's just like, "Sorry, do you mind if I have your cigarette?"
Or takes it off him.
Yeah.
That's great.
Probably still soaked in oil from it. Yeah. Anyway, fast forwarding a few years, we've got another McLaren driver and latterly Ferrari. That's Kimi Raikkonen, who during his racing career, he always had this nickname, the Iceman. He's a Finnish driver, although apparently at McLaren, he had another nickname. They called him Pingu because he sounds like Pingu when he speaks.
Have you got meep meep.
I love the idea of them being in the garage and being like calling him Iceman to his face. Yeah, and then when he's not in the room, he's just like, where the fuck's Pingu?
And obviously getting it mixed up at some point.
Kimi, you missed the presentation by Pele.
Yeah.
Will you get over it?
Yeah, I was having a shit.
Okay, thanks for that.
I was having a shit.
Scandi's just don't give a shit about
that.
I was having a shit. He does actually sound a lot like Pingu.
Yeah.
There was this great moment in the Monaco Grand Prix where Kimi's car broke down and he like climbs out and climbs over the barriers and you're expecting him to just walk back to the pit garage to reflect with his team about what happened. And instead he just sort of wanders off. You see him like hop another couple of barriers and then gets on board a yacht, still in his full like race overalls with his helmet on. Gets onto this yacht where all of his mates from Finland are, and then they just hand him a glass of champagne and he gets in the hot tub with them and just watches the rest of the race from there.
Love it.
Yeah, there's another yacht story. He was spotted one time on the top deck of this super yacht and he's like super drunk and tries to throw a pole like a javelin style off the edge of the yacht and just topples over the edge and falls head first down the side of the boat. Yeah, he's one of the most infamous boozers of the more recent years. So there's this story from 2004 in Gran Canaria where he goes on holiday with a group of his mates and basically has this huge 7-hour bender at the Playa del Ingles resort. So he's apparently got this huge wad of cash with him and he keeps on just slapping down 100 euro bills on the counter, paying for everybody's drinks, like propositioning waitresses. At some point of the night, he finds this inflatable dolphin that he's carrying around with him for the rest of the night. He goes into this restaurant and he's like parading it around between the tables, starts wrestling with it on the floor whilst like grabbing customers' drinks off their table and necking them. He's then later on kicked out of a nightclub for, in the words of Finnish papers, having intimate relations with the dolphin on the dance floor.
Was there like a blowhole on the dolphin?
I guess.
So a stag do dolphin. Yeah.
Dolphins apparently do have sex like with the blowhole.
Do they?
I heard that. Really? Does that make sense?
It makes sense.
Well, what would go in it? Yeah, I guess they have penises, don't they, the men?
But with other dolphins? Or?
You're both looking at me quite.
I mean, it was an inflatable dolphin, so it at least had one hole for, for blowing up. He then, after he gets kicked out of the nightclub, heads to another bar where there's a Finnish pop star performing. Kimmy gets up on stage and starts grabbing the mic, trying to join in on the songs. Eventually, people find it funny to begin with, but it gets too much. And one of the other singers tries to drag him off and he almost gets in a fight with them, gets kicked out. He's later photographed by paparazzi, curled up asleep on the street with his inflatable dolphin.
Still got the dolphin.
Yeah.
Sagging a bit by now, I imagine. Looking a bit sad, the dolphin.
It's fully deflated, really.
Develops a real bond to these two.
Yeah.
All right, well, it's not all champagne and shagging. There were also, in the golden age of F1, there were what I would call sort of friendly japes. And one of my favourite pairings was Gerhard Berger, who was a sort of middling, jobbing F1 driver. He never won the title or anything, but he had these few years at McLaren in the early 90s where he was with the great Ayrton Senna. And Berger was partial to a practical joke. So he played some pretty good ones on Senna. At the Australian Grand Prix, he got hold of some wild frogs. And while Ayrton Senna was out of his room, he filled his room with the frogs. And eventually also, I swear frogs can be like poisonous in Australia. Yes,
sort of biblical plague.
Yeah. Anyway, Senna apparently then turned up at his door being like, "What the fuck? I've just been getting rid of all these frogs in my room." And he just replied, "Did you find the snake?" So Senna's obviously freaking out for a while. Senna then got revenge by getting hold of some really smelly French cheese and filling the air conditioning unit in Gerhard Berger's room with it and sticking it on full pelt, stinking out his room a bit. I'd say in general, Senna's responses are quite tame. So like he would like glue together Gerhard's credit cards and it was like, oh, very funny. And then Berger once spiked Senna's orange juice with 5 sleeping pills on the day of the Japanese Grand Prix.
Just like, on the day of the race.
I mean, would have killed him.
That is ridiculous. Yeah.
Apparently Senna didn't drink it. He smelled a rat. So I think maybe he was like, have some orange juice. Yeah. But I mean,
Berger wasn't about on the fateful day, was he?
Where were you?
1994.
Ayrton didn't drink any orange juice on that day. Was he hoping that the sleeping pills would kick in before the race? Because otherwise...
Yeah, if it's mid-race, then surely that's...
It's quite savage. It's quite a response to gluing together someone's... cling filming the loose scene. Yeah. It's like, well, I'll just stab him. Another one he did. This one's quite good. They were flying to Argentina for the Grand Prix, and he nicked Senna's passport, and obviously back then passports were quite sort of cut and paste jobs, and he replaced his passport photo with just a picture of a cock and balls. When Senna got to customs, the Argentine customs officials just like, you can picture them looking at the passport, looking back at his face, straight face. They detained him for 24 hours. Obviously Ayrton Senna is Brazilian and one of the most famous people on the planet at the time, but they were still like, we are banging you up for 24 hours.
That's a good one.
That's so funny.
Good pranks from Gerhard. He also stole Paul McKenna's wife, the famous hypnotist. Do you know who I mean?
Yeah.
Older listeners will be familiar with Paul McKenna.
Paul McKenna? Yeah, can make you thin.
Famous hypnotist who can make you thin. And Berger was spotted in cavorting with his wife in Toronto, I think.
Mm.
So a bit of a shagger as well. Anyway, from those friendly japes, I've got a slightly darker character. Max Verstappen dominates the sport now, and his single-minded genius probably comes as no surprise when you learn about his father and how he raised him. His father, Jos, was a sort of like middling driver, late 90s, early noughties. But when he wasn't on the circuit, he was raising his son with an iron fist. So when Max Verstappen was 14, he lost a go-karting race, And on the drive home, they're in southern Italy, middle of nowhere. His dad just dumped him outside a random petrol station. He was so angry with him and just said, get out, you can walk home. So,
in Italy?
Yeah, in the middle of southern Italy. Just like, so you can walk home. And he was 5 miles away from their hotel. And apparently when he finally got back to the hotel, Jos didn't speak to him for a week. So yeah, a bit of a psycho. But Max probably got off lightly compared to a bloke who got into a disagreement with Jos and his dad, so Max's granddad, Franz. They got into an argument with this guy at a go-karting track about whose turn it was to go first, and the bloke ended up with a fractured skull.
Is this like go-kart, what do you say to go first? Is this just a go-kart track, a sort of birthday party?
Is it
competitive?
Some eight-year-olds. Yeah. Jos Verstappen.
Yeah. Cracking skulls.
Cracking skulls. Yeah, I mean, apparently they settled out of court, so I think you get a lighter sentence in Germany. But then Franz, Jos's granddad, then accused Jos of beating him up. And so towards the end of Franz's life, they didn't speak. He still spoke to Max. Because I sort of assumed maybe Jos had got it from his dad, but I don't know what's going on there. But beating up your own dad's pretty hardcore. And then also on the rap sheet is the time he sort of a little bit accidentally ran over his ex-girlfriend and was charged with attempted murder. Although in the interest of fairness, we should say that she then dropped the charges and married him. And then they divorced 3 years later, unsurprisingly.
Mm.
So yeah, bit of a terrifying figure.
He does, sounds quite horrible.
Yeah, I thought we'd have one slightly dark one amid all the fun. Yeah. We're having too much fun, we'd get her bugger.
Sort of the opposite of comic relief.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Okay, so for the next one, we're going to go back to the 1960s, which is the era of F1 where everything is just terrifyingly dangerous. This story is about Jackie Stewart, the three-time world champion. So it's the 1966 Belgian Grand Prix, and just as the race begins, the cars are just pulling away and there's this absolutely biblical downpour. So the whole track is covered in like an inch of water. Cars are skidding about everywhere. On the first lap, half of the field crash out. And by the first corner of the second lap, there's only seven drivers still in the race. Jackie Stewart crashes out at 170 miles an hour. He says, he's recording this, he says, "First I hit a telegraph pole and then a woodcutter's cottage, and I finished up in the outside basement of a farm building. The car ended up shaped like a banana." I don't know why there's like a farm building. And
well, you need to have tracks in farmland, I guess.
I guess, yeah.
So woodcutter's cottage. Woodcutter's cottage. Sort of like Hansel and Gretel, like medieval.
Brothers Grimm.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Then an elderly old crone came and offered me three wishes. Hope he dropped his breadcrumbs. Is there a windmill coming up?
There are some quite fairy tale characters coming up. So anyway, Jackie Stewart is really badly injured. He's trapped in the cockpit, like barely conscious. The engine is sort of ruptured and there's fuel gushing out all over him. And he's like desperately trying to get out, but he's completely locked in. But as luck has it, his teammate, Graham Hill crashes out at the same corner, not so badly, just like goes into some bales of hay and spots this hole in the hedge. He's like, what's that? So goes to investigate and finds Jackie in like the mangled wreck of this car, covered in fuel. And he's like one spark away from, you know, death. And he's trying to pull him out, but the steering wheel's like locked him in place. So he's like, fuck, we need to get a spanner or something. So he rushes off. The stewards are nowhere to be seen. He finds a spectator and borrows a toolkit off him and goes back and eventually manages to get the steering wheel off and pull him to safety. And he drags him into this nearby barn or woodcutter's cottage, maybe. I think it was.
Gingerbread house. Just happened to be.
Yeah. There were seven dwarves that helped him, helped to drag him clear of the wreckage. No, so he pulls him into this barn and Jackie's like barely conscious and covered in fuel, which is like burning his skin. So he decides that he needs to get these overalls off him. And so like strips him naked basically and strips himself naked as well, because he's also got covered in fuel. And at this point realizes that Jackie's struggling to breathe. So he's like, shit, I need to do mouth to mouth. So he like gets him on the floor, gets on top of him and presses his lips to Jackie's mouth and is like breathing in and out. At which point the medical staff belatedly arrive on the scene, and this medical team just happened to be the local nuns who come into this barn and see these two naked men cavorting on the floor, one with like his mouth locked to the other one. And you know, they're sort of like, oh my god, say a few Hail Marys. And eventually like Graham explains what has happened, and then kind of load him up into an ambulance. The ambulance then gets lost on its way to the hospital.
Fuck, so went up a beanstalk instead.
Yeah, he does recover, fortunately.
Lives to tell the tale.
Yeah, he lives to tell the tale.
Is that Graham Hill's, Damon Hill's dad, isn't he?
Lisa, yeah.
Yeah. That was a great story.
Such a like Carry On film sort of tale.
Yeah, that's so Carry On. That's great. All right, well, no list of F1 characters would be complete without Bernie Eccleston.
Mm.
A man often referred to as the supremo of F1. So he basically made his fortune and his name by getting control of the TV rights to F1 and turned it into the sort of like mega $1 billion sport that it is today. And he also had a lot of control of the sport. Bernie is 5'3". He's an inveterate sexist, an admirer of Hitler. He's a tax dodger. He's got quite Bond villain energy, I would say, as well, especially because he often is seen with those sort of like dark glasses, kind of smoky lenses. And last year, actually, he was caught boarding a plane in Brazil with a gun in his hand luggage, just cruising around with a shooter. But he also has this like East End 60s, you know, crime adjacent wheeler dealer vibe. So there's quite a nice story that illustrates how he's always up for a nice little earner. Mario Andretti, who I think was a driver, you know, I'm talking 70s, they were in a hotel, they're like at a party and Bernie was by the pool, and someone said to Andretti, I'll give you $1,000 to push Bernie in the pool because he'll fucking hate it. So Mario went over to do it and then bottled it, was too scared, and Bernie sort of noticed him being shifty and was like, what's going on? And Mario explained, oh, they've offered me this to push you in, and Bernie just goes, give me 500 and you can do it. And he just took up the money. So I bet you're a billionaire. But he just loves Lerner. I thought that was quite endearing.
You can say the boy out of East End.
Yeah. Do you remember he also got mugged for his Hublot watch, like outside his house in like Chelsea? And they left him with that really bad black eye. And most people would be like traumatized and in counseling. It was quite a nasty beating. But the next week he just did an ad campaign for Hublot. Obviously they paid him, and it was a picture of him beating up and it said, some people will do anything for a Hublot. So he's just always looking out for the nice earner. There were actually even rumours that he was involved in the Great Train Robbery, which is probably the most iconic sort of gangster move of that era. So the reason he was rumoured to be involved is that he was friends with the getaway driver from the robbery, a man known as Roy the Weasel James. What an era. So the Weasel was the getaway driver. He was eventually jailed. And Bernie said, naturally, when he got out, I gave him a job working for F1, making the trophies, because he used to be a goldsmith. So obviously this rumour spread that, you know, the Grand Train Robbery, they nicked gold mainly, I think, gold and silver. So the rumour is that the F1 trophies are made with gold from the Great Train Robbery. Bernie's obviously always denied this. I think it's probably apocryphal, but when it was finally put to Eccleston, were you involved in the robbery? He just said, "Ah, there wasn't enough money on that train. I could have done something way better than that." So yeah, quite like that about him. He's also, having fathered a child at the age of 89, he is the seventh oldest father ever in recorded history.
Wow.
He's one place behind Julio Iglesias, who is Enrique Iglesias' gynecologist grandfather, who fathered a child in his 90s. Obviously, these days, he's too old and full of Viagra to indulge in the kind of filthy power plays that he once did in F1. But just because he's old doesn't mean Bernie can't enjoy a younger despot from the comfort of his sofa. And he is, of course, a massive fan and friend of Vladimir Putin.
Of course he is.
He's always said Putin should run Europe. And after Russia invaded Ukraine, he said, "I'd take a bullet for him. Putin is a first-class person." Which is pretty mental.
Wow. So, because was he not calling for Christian Horner to resign after this alleged inappropriate pick? He wanted Horner to resign for an inappropriate pick, but Putin invading Ukraine.
Yeah, you can flatten the Donbass, but if you not send an inappropriate photo, whatever you do. Priorities.
He's of that kind of Murdoch category of just utter like power, mad.
Reptile.
Yeah.
But it's weird. I have to say, I've always thought of him as a bit of an arsehole. And I think the Putin thing I really don't like. But when I sort of discovered a bit more of the like 60s gangster adjacent stuff, I started to feel quite like warm and nostalgic about Bernie Eccleston.
I didn't know that side to him. I just, in my head, he's just this like sleazy Bond villain character who's always got like two supermodels on each side.
Yeah, I think he is that as well. But he's got this like hinterland that is kind of, I don't know, romantic. Am I romanticising like some really unpleasant gangsters? I really wanted to name my son like Ronnie or Reggie, not specifically after the craze. Yeah, or Bernie. Yeah, like a 60s East End gangster name. So yeah. I think
Bernie's a great name, actually.
Yeah, Bernie is a good name. Anyway, and I didn't realise Bernie had such a strong link to that. But he's a billionaire now. He always says, "I didn't make my money through F1. I made it through property." But he did. He basically wangled a deal in the, I think, 80s, where he would get a quarter of all the revenue from F1 because he controlled the TV rights. And him and Max Mosley basically carved up the sport, where Mosley would take the like legislative side and Bernie would take the commercial side, and they would sort of act like they often disagreed on stuff, and then there would be this like, "Oh, we've patched it up and done a deal" thing. But I think they were basically just stitching the sport up.
Yeah, and they worked with Bernie in particular, would broke deals with each of the individual teams. If you think about like F1, the teams are the ones with the power, because without the teams, then the sport would be nothing. And he was working sort of in this clandestine way where he'd pit them all against each other and nobody really know what sort of money they were getting, and basically through sleight of hand, make them sign away like rights and stuff. He was, I mean, like talented in the art of the deal, but he was devious.
Yeah, Machiavellian.
Yeah Machiavellian.
In a way, he paved the way for the Premier League, a lot of people say. Like, he invented this like ultra commercial sport. Max Mosley, his old pal, obviously went a slightly different route. I'm not going to go into his whole, well, actually, let's do it. Mosley's dad, Oswald, was a fascist politician who famously had Hitler as the guest of honour at his wedding. And yeah, I think Max, like, gradually over time, having stood for Mosley's party post-war, which was a sort of fascist reboot, Max over time kind of distanced himself from it. But there was always a bit of a lingering question over whether he was a Nazi. And obviously this formed the justification for the News of the World sting, one of the most famous tabloid stings ever, where the News of the World ran the front page story, "F1 boss in vile Nazi orgy." So the story was that Max Mosley had been having these five-hour orgies with these five dominatrices. Is that the plural?
The plural of dominatrix.
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 Dominatrices. With dominatrixes. And Mosley was videoing them, and somehow the News of the World got their grubby paws on the video footage. And this week, in preparation for this podcast, in the interest of journalism, I reread the News of the World sting.
I thought you were going to say you watched the tapes.
I couldn't get hold of it.
Shame.
Wouldn't rule it out. It's pretty funny. Obviously, Mosley sued them in court and won. And his argument was, "You've invaded my privacy and you don't have any right to, because there wasn't a Nazi element. The whole case hinged on whether it was a Nazi element or not. And the News of the World insists there were. I mean, the dominatrices were dressed in Luftwaffe uniforms. Some of them were in prison outfits. They were inspected for lice and like had their genitals measured, and they were barking in German. So make of that what you will. Obviously, Max is no longer with us, so I'm not super concerned about the legal side, but, you know, I want to be fair. But I thought I'd just read a few extracts. Here's a line from the News of the World story. Red-faced and panting, Mosley looks on like a child in a sweet shop, but surrounded by bright red bottoms. Apparently he does quite a lot of like barking orders in German, but then sometimes will slip into English in a German accent. And apparently at one point, one of the dominatrixes is spanking one of the others who's in like the prisoner role. And Mosley just goes, "She needs more of the punishment." German accent. And then the News of the World, obviously they really need to act like this is like this sick Nazi thing to justify their story. But they also can't resist like the odd gag. So there's a bit where they're like, last week Mosley led a crackdown on abuse in the sport, but on Friday, the only crackdowns Mosley was interested in were on bare buttocks, including his own. yeah, and it's all very salacious. It's just he sort of does a bit of, he's the dominant one and then he's the submissive one, gets a real beating. He has to have a wound dressing put on his backside at one point. Yeah, it's wild stuff.
Wow. It was a story that ultimately led to the downfall of the News of the World, wasn't it? Because Mosley was he funded all of the celebrities who took the News of the World to court for the phone hacking scandal, didn't he? And he said, if you lose, I'll bankroll you, so you've got nothing to lose. And without Mosley's financial backing, the News of the World would probably still be about.
Yeah, that's mad.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I actually think they did invade his privacy and he
should have... What, you mean filming an orgy that he had in his home? You reckon that's amazing?
But basically their argument was, this guy who's the son of a fascist and stood for a fascist party has Nazi sympathies and that there's a public interest in knowing that. I mean, I kind of think you have a right to have a Nazi orgy if you want.
I think it's kink-shaming, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I actually do think that.
Yeah.
I'm happy to repeat all of it on my podcast, but I mean, his privacy has already been invaded.
There's definitely a public interest.
Well, it's definitely interesting to the public.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing, yeah. Zach. Do you think the public has a right to know?
So, do they have a right to know? I kind of think maybe, yeah. If it's because of his sort of backstory, to be honest, nobody should be having Nazi themed orgies, really.
You don't think you have a right to? Or you know,
should you have? I don't know. It's the same. Like, should you have a Nazi themed party?
No.
If you had a Nazi, if somebody threw a Nazi themed Halloween party, would you think that's cool?
I wouldn't make it illegal. But then the News of the World won't make it illegal. They're just exposing.
No,
it.
But then yeah. if a public figure had a Nazi themed Halloween party,
do the public have a right to public, know?
Yeah, I would say so. So yeah, I would say yes. And then if they do, does it make it okay that it's an orgy?
I think the judge said if it was a Nazi orgy, you would have a right to publish it. But I'm not convinced it was, which I find possibly.
Surely the Luftwaffe costumes were a bit of a giveaway. I think I made my mind up when I heard about those.
The Luftwaffe was actually formed before the formation of the National Socialist Party, who inherited the Luftwaffe.
The moment he pretended to flatten London's East End, I thought the Einsatzgruppenführer marched in black boots.
It wasn't Nazi themed, it was merely Luftwaffe themed.
I think that's what he basically
said. Actually, the Second Reich that we were going for.
It was more Bismarcky. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the German alone was a bit of a giveaway. It's kind of fascinating that that's what he's into, just given his background. His parents were mates with Hitler.
Yeah. Maybe they went to some parties like that.
Oh, I bet. I bet. They were all into all sorts of shit.
Like the Führer bunkers.
Anyway, yeah, I digress. Yeah. Bigger villain, Max Mosley or Bernie Eccleston?
Mosley.
Yeah, no, Mosley. I think Mosley.
I think the standing for the fascist party.
Yeah, that clinches it. I mean, but mate, no questions about it. Eccleston is also an absolute wrong-in.
Yeah, he is a wrong-in. Yeah, I've romanticised him slightly more than I should have. He's a wrong-in.
All I can think of him is great train robbery, which is almost certainly untrue.
I think it's clear that he was not involved in it. But I love that he gave the getaway driver a job making trophies. Yeah. Britain's most famous gold thief. Perfect. Right.
Yeah.
Have you got a nice clean one for us after that, Zach?
Well, clean-ish. No, actually, not really.
Perfect.
So we've got, it's a less familiar name for you, and that is Tommy Byrne, who is an Irish driver. He only actually managed a few races in F1 in 1982, despite his immense talent. Eddie Jordan actually said that the only drivers that matched Tommy's talent were Ayrton Senna and Michael Schumacher. So he was very good. Unfortunately, his lifestyle didn't quite match that of an elite sportsman. So Tommy made his name in Formula 3. There was a story from they had a race in France and their qualifying got rained off. So him and his team went to a local cafe and he drank like 7 or 8 Irish coffees, at which point word got through that the rain had cleared up and qualifying was back on. just went back and just did qualifying, qualified 6th.
Drunk.
It would have been pretty wide as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it helped. he won the Formula 3 title and bagged himself a drive at Theodore, who were one of the sort of backmarking F1 teams. But the car was pretty shit, so he did 5 races with them. 3 of them he didn't even qualify for, and the other 2 he retired because the car like broke down or something. And at the end of his last race, he like completely lost the plot, threw chairs at the team and told them to shove it up their arse.
Been on the Irish coffees again?
Possibly. or worse. So part of the reason I think that he was so ballsy in that instance was because he'd been invited along to test drive the McLaren at Silverstone. And the McLaren at that point were one of the best teams. So he was finally thinking like, all right, this is my chance to actually get in a decent car and show what I can do. So the day that he gets the offer of this test drive, he goes out to celebrate. And this is his recollection of the day. A friend of mine gave me a big bag of cocaine and I was snorting it all day long. At the end of the night, I couldn't take any more and I gave it to one of my friends. And he said, that's not coke, it's speed. And I was like, it's the same, right? And he said, no, not really. After the prize giving, I was lying in bed for 3 days crying. That was the end of my F1 dream.
Or never raced again.
No, so he did do the test drive, but a night before the test, he got really stoned with a bunch of girls that he met, who he then brought along to watch him do the test drive. Unsurprisingly, McLaren didn't select him for a race seat. Although he claims that his test was rigged and that the McLaren engineers had turned down the throttle on his car before he got in. So he says that he, years later, like 20 years later, had met one of the engineers and they admitted that it was a whole sort of plot by Ron Dennis, McLaren team boss, because they basically didn't want him to do really well in this test and then be forced into replacing one of their existing drivers with him.
Do you think they were also thinking,
they were also just like,
just seeing you do a whole bag of speed. Just going to turn the throttle back.
A charge.
Given you got fucking whiz all over your nose.
You're actually going to drive this Mini Cooper instead.
One of those stationary ones outside shops for children.
You probably won't notice.
Fucking hell.
So his F1 career is pretty short-lived, and he then moves to the US and then to Mexico to race single-seater cars, also to party. So he says of his time in Mexico, I took enough drugs to kill a buffalo. So at this point, he's earning like 100 grand a year. He's sponsored by Corona and Nokia, kind of living the life. He has this story, he has an all-night party with the president of Nokia, where he says they almost died of tequila poisoning. He also makes friends with this Mexican millionaire called Nacho. So they first meet because Nacho is buying a helmet off him. And he's sort of waiting by the side of the road for this guy to pick him up. And this car pulls up and there's 2 guys and he gets in. And the guy in the back seat just has a gun. And he's like, fuck, okay, I think I know what's going to happen here. So he's either going to get robbed or murdered. And then they're all like speaking in Spanish and he kind of doesn't understand what's going on. And then they wind down the window and put the gun out. And he's like, fuck, they're not going to kill me. They're just going to, it's going to be like a drive-by. Turns out it's all fine. They're just shooting at road signs. But anyway, still a bit of a character. And him and Nacho become really good friends, hang out a lot. And one night, Tommy is hosting a relaxing orgy at his house, as you do. And suddenly, these naked girls come running down the stairs and then Nacho appears at the bottom of the stairs with a gun. And Tommy says that this is his account of the story. He ran out with his gun naked, and I just said, ¿Qué pasa, amigo? And he just took the gun and shot at me twice. So fortunately, Nacho misses, and Tommy like locks himself in a room with these girls. And then at that point decides like, it's time to get out of Mexico. A couple of weeks later, Nacho is found dead in a swimming pool. He's apparently worth 40 million at the time.
Right.
So, you know, this sort of gun-toting Mexican millionaire hosting cocaine-fueled orgies where he tries to shoot his best friend. Is yeah. Kind of guessing that Nacho wasn't just the president of a local chain of restaurants.
Yeah, I think we know what his job was, especially when he's found floating in his pool. Yeah. That whole story is like something out of like Narcos.
Yeah, it really is.
Proper Breaking Bad.
Why did he shoot at his friend?
I don't know. He doesn't explain that. Just
psychosis.
That would make sense.
Seemed like such a nice, level-headed guy at that point. Not
But at that point, Tommy decides to like get out of that life and moves to Ohio and becomes a driving instructor. Where he still is now.
He's a driving instructor.
Yeah.
Fuck, can you imagine having driving lessons with a former F1 driver? Yeah.
Sounds a lot like a witness relocation scheme, doesn't
it? It does, yeah. Ohio. Just in Cleveland.
It's not the end of Goodfellas.
Yeah. Driving instructors do often talk a lot of shit as well, do you find?
My driving instructor,
he'd always be like, oh yeah, do you know David Beckham? I'd be like, yeah, I know who David Beckham is. And he'd be like, I'm friends with him. Okay. And you'd like go past a famous person's house, tell you who it is and be like, yeah, we're friends. So imagine if you're having lessons with him and he's like, oh yeah, no, I was friends with this Mexican drug lord. And you'd be like, yeah, of course, yeah. Mate. I raced an F1.
Yeah.
Of course you did.
Yeah. Please, just teach me 3-point turns. I don't want to hear your bullshit. Yeah.
I think that's all the wrong uns, isn't it? They're not all wrong uns, sorry, I should say. All the characters that we've run through.
Not a wrong un, but can I throw out an honourable mention to current Mercedes team principal Toto Wolff? There's a funny moment quite recently where he appeared on Desert Island Discs with Lauren Laverne, the famous Radio 4 show, in which guests choose 8 tracks that signify big moments in their life. And his list is just one of the worst playlists you've ever come across. He had We Are the Champion by Queen. He had a Phil Collins number. Proper, now that's what I call kind of like...
Yeah, karaoke.
Karaoke classics. But there's this clip here where he effectively chooses a song about a man's unrequited love for a prostitute in honour of his own mother.
Tell us what we're going to hear next, am I?
I've chosen Mama from Genesis. The background of the song, it's about a young man and probably a sex worker, and he just starves for her attention. And it's something that I can relate to, not to the sex worker, but for me personally, the title Mama is where my mother had to be a bit remote to protect herself. And I can relate to that feeling that you're not getting emotionally what you feel you need or want. It's a total love deprivation in a way, but not done on purpose. It doesn't kind of match.
Even on Desert Island Discs, there is such a thing as too honest.
Yeah. Nice. Also, there are like things I love about this. Two things. First of all, he calls it From Genesis, as if he's talking about the book of Genesis. And then the secondly is that there's literally songs about exactly what he's talking about. Like Mother by John Lennon is literally about what he's talking about. It's like, I just love the how he can only sort of think in sort of like prostitute terminology.
Yeah, and he's understood, he said it's a sex worker. He's understood that part of it.
Yeah.
It's like, when I became successful in Formula One, my mother no longer needed to go to work. And I was telling her, you can retire, you can enjoy your retirement. She said, no, I want to go back to work. So I'm going to choose Roxanne by The Police.
Yeah, it's just 7 songs of us prostitutes. This one reminds me of my mother. Yeah, that's a great honorable mention.
Play your friend's impression is so good.
Oh yeah. Cool. Although this could be for the extra cut, but
yeah.
So yeah, when this happened, we were texting my mates about it. My mate George did a very funny impression, which Jack actually thought was Toto.
I thought it was until the end.
Yeah. Should I play it?
We'll play it as a little Easter egg at the end.
All right, well, I hope this has provided the perfect companion for the new F1 season. It'll take the edge off the glamour in Bahrain. Thanks very much, Zach.
Thank you, Jack.
And thank you, George.
Thank you very much.
Please do share this with your petrol-ed mates. And see you next time. Thanks a lot.
Tell us what we're going to hear next, am I?
I remember once when I was, I think, 17 in Vienna. My high school girlfriend ended our relationship. So I went out that night with some of my friends and I was trying to hide how upset I felt. My mother used to call it feeling blue. I was really not enjoying myself that night until this song came on that just perfectly described how I felt, and it means a lot to me. And now whenever I feel sad, I put it on and dance until I feel better. And that song was A Decade in Blue by Eiffel 65.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.